So we watched that movie Matinee last week, the John Goodman movie about 1960s cinema, and it had the movie within the movie was Mant, the man who gets bitten by a radioactive ant. Or no, he got bit by an ant at the same time that he was getting dental surgery,
That's right.
which was putting radiation into his body, and the two things combined to make him Mant. And you were saying how that's obviously all the movies in that were like inspired by real movies, but the closest one to that seems to be The Fly. And I realized I've never seen particularly the Cronenberg Fly from the 80s. It's such a famous movie. It's always been on my list of like, I really got to watch that movie sometime. And that seemed like a pretty good opportunity since we just watched Matinee. I was like, maybe we should watch The Fly. But then I realized, well, I mean, to jump straight to the 80s one, because from what I understand, it's like a body horror movie, like quite a different scenario. Seems like pretty different than the original. And I was like, well, since the inspiration for this idea was Mant, why don't we watch the 50s version first? We can watch the 50s Fly this week and then the 80s Fly next week. So, have you ever seen the 1958 version of The Fly?
Yep, I have. I've seen both of them.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to make you watch them again because I haven't seen them. How recently have you seen the old version of The
Oh,
Fly?
God. Both of them, it's got to be 20 years.
Yeah, so it's about time for a renewal.
The original Fly, though, oh, God, that's probably 30, 35 years ago that I saw it. Maybe longer.
Yeah, so that can be interesting in a different way too, right? Of just like, how does it hold up? How close is it to what you remember or whatnot? So, does anything stand out in it particularly in your memory? Because is he? I mean, I guess I'll find out when I watch it. Is he a man-sized fly or is he a tiny fly who speaks in this version?
Well, he becomes a man-sized fly, but originally it's just a small little fly, of course, your standard household fly.
Okay, so he's both. I guess I'm kind of just pulling from Simpsons parodies, I'm not quite sure what goes where, but
But he starts off with things like when he starts to convert, how flies always have that, like their front leg, they're always kind of like rubbing their face or whatever. It starts with just little things like that, little motions that are very fly-like. And then, yeah, he just kind of becomes the fly, like a man fly. I don't know what else to tell you.
yeah, I mean that's the name on the tin, right? Like that's what's advertised. So the little bit I looked up about it, it seems like this movie, it does seem like it stood out from. It was definitely a B movie, but it was I think in a double feature with what was the movie called? Just hold on.
I think I probably saw the original Fly when I was a kid, and then I saw it. I've seen it again as years have come and gone. But yeah, I think I was probably a kid when I saw that originally, probably at the Laugh and Scratch Theater.
Right. See last week for details on the Laugh and Scratch. Yeah, it was released in 1958 as a double feature with Space Master X7. So like it was one of those types of movies. It
Okay,
was.
don't know Space Master X7.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does,
Don't know that one.
but I think even just the very nature of. I mean, I feel like the remake of The Fly is the main reason why my generation is so aware of The Fly, like kept it in the consciousness. Same thing with like The Thing, how there was a 50s version of The Thing,
Who
and
is the
then.
fly in the area? It's not Vincent Price, is it?
He's in it, but no, I will see.
Or maybe he's the doctor. I don't know.
David Hedison?
Don't know that name either.
Yeah, this guy who plays the fly, he was in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, a couple of James Bond movies. But yeah, the idea though that this movie got released as a double feature, even that it's called The Fly, like it's obvious what type of movie this is, that it was one of those, matinee type movies. But it does seem like it stood above them. It was better than your average, B movie about a guy who turns into a fly. But when I was reading up about it, it's like it was financially successful. It seems like it was basically the most successful movie pretty much everybody in it had been involved with up to that point, and it helped Vincent Price become much more of a household name. But at the same time, the reviews at the time were pretty middling. People were like, is this guy with a weird fly head on? And like, am I supposed to take this serious? Or apparently there's some parts that by 1958 standards, people found very distasteful and gross. So, because if I know anything about the Cronenberg one, it's that whole thing is gross. So, I wonder what the 1958 version of
But in
gross
the
will be.
50s, too, you have to remember that that was okay after the atomic bomb went off in Japan. in 1945. And so there were many, many movies in the 1950s that were about mutation as a result of the fallout from nuclear bombs and warfare and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of fits right in that you'd have Mant or The Fly or whatever. There were lots of movies out at that time about the things that, as a result of nuclear fusion, that all these weird mutations would happen. So this was probably just seen as just another one of those movies.
Well, I do think it's funny, in the Wikipedia page at the bottom, they just have "see also," you know, just other things that you may be interested in for further reading. The Wasp Woman, a 1959 film. But, you know, I've never heard of that one. It's probably not as notable as The Fly. But basically, even though I was saying the reviews at the time were a little middling, it does seem like, in hindsight, you know, it's won a bunch of awards, or like AFI top horror films type of thing. You know, it's gotten a lot more accolades since then. But because, you know, it does, in some ways, there's not a ton of trivia about this film itself, because it was just, in a weird way, similar to like Casablanca or whatever, just like movies that you're just grinding it out. You're just trying to make another movie to keep your studio afloat, and just sometimes they're successful. So maybe this movie's not as successful as Casablanca, but you know, you just never know quite which ones are going to hit. But it's not like they were setting out to do some great thing. It just works out. Or in my era, I think of Reanimator. It's this movie from the 80s that's just a Lovecraft movie. Should have just been another whatever movie that you put on the shelf in the VHS store, but it's amazing. It's like, great, maybe we should watch that sometime. Just sometimes they just turn out really well. So yeah, I'm curious, because I do feel like it's the remake that really seems to have solidified The Fly in the public consciousness, but this one seems like it was no slouch either. So I'm curious. I'll be curious to see them. But what's easier to sink your teeth into, I guess, as far as like interesting trivia, is where this came from. Is it was based on a short story written just a year before in Playboy magazine. Like, you know that joke of, I read Playboy for the articles? It's interesting that in the 50s, that was kind of true. Like, it was a pretty legit magazine. It had all kinds of neat stuff going on in it, not just hot dames.
Yeah, the babes were just aside.
Just a bonus, yeah. So it was written...
Sure they were.
It was written by Georges Langelan. He's a French guy from Paris. And this guy's life was bananas. So he eventually became a writer and he wrote The Fly. But before that, during World War II, Langelan worked as a spy and special agent for the Allied powers as part of the Special Operations Executive. He was a lieutenant, and according to his memoirs, he underwent plastic surgery to alter his appearance before being dropped into France. The surgery was deemed necessary to remove features that were too distinctive. So, I mean, to me, that sounds crazy. That sounds like some, like, Face-Off stuff. Like, what do you mean? What did they do to him? Turns out it wasn't that bad. It was just that his ears were too large. He had these very distinctive ears. And I guess as a spy, you don't want something that someone can easily say, who was that suspicious guy with the big ears? Like, if stuff goes down, they're going to remember you because of your one distinctive feature.
Yeah, if you had, like, a hooked nose,
right,
you'd stand out. And big ears.
Yeah,
and a big nose. Yeah. You better do something with yourself to make yourself look just, I don't want to say normal, but just nondescript.
Yeah, you don't want to stand out.
Nothing special about you.
So he explained later in his memoir that, it was because of the ears. They had to do this surgery to pin back his ears. And I looked that up. Like, I've heard that before, but what does that mean? It's a little severe, but it's not as terrible. It's like they take out some of the cartilage in your ear, and they literally push your ear back against your head, and they just put in permanent stitches to hold your ear against your head so it doesn't stick out. And here's a picture of the guy. And yeah, he does have big ears.
They do kind of stick out.
I mean, in day-to-day life, no one would ever care. But I guess, you know, if you want to be a tip-top spy, like, that is exactly the kind of thing. People might not remember your face or remember anything else, but they would remember your ears.
So what does he look like later? Did they show that?
This is the only picture of him. I assume in his later civilian life, he let his ears be unpinned.
Yeah, you kind of want to see a before and after.
So that was the beginning of his spy stuff. But he parachuted into occupied France September 1941 to make contact with the French resistance forces south of Châteauroux. This is like all getting like way heavy into all this war stuff that I don't know. But he was captured and imprisoned in the Mauzac camp, condemned to death by the Nazis. But he escaped in July 1942, returned to England, and participated in the Normandy landings. and received the French Croix de Guerre. So this guy did all kinds of stuff. And then once the war was over, he wrote The Freakin' Fly. Like, good job, my dude. Good job, George. So yeah, that's where I thought, instead of really digging into details about the movie, you know, we'll just watch the movie and we'll get what we get out of that. But I was like, let's just talk about this guy who wrote it, because you could make another movie just about this guy. Yeah, his adventures, getting his ears pinned back and dropping in and getting in a POW camp and escaping. And then the fact that he escaped and he still wasn't like, whew, like, let me just sit this one out. Then he was in Normandy. Like, holy heck. Just impressive to read.
And then he comes out and writes a world famous movie.
Yeah. Yeah, not bad. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know that you could ask for much more than that out of your life.
You lived a full life.
Yeah. So, in tribute to George Langelin, let's watch The Fly. And also just so we can watch a movie about a guy who turns into a fly. You know, we'll do it for our own entertainment too. But yeah, I just love stuff like that. It's interesting when you look up stuff. And
did he write other things?
He did, but again, it's very much like most known for The Fly. You know, sometimes, I mean, again,
he wasn't just a one-hit wonder. He was a writer.
Yeah, well, even beyond that, I mean, even if he was a bit of a one-hit wonder as a writer, it's just gravy on the top of his life that he wrote anything. Like, it's like, I think you've done plenty already, my friend. So yeah, The Fly, 1958. It's one weird thing about old movies, right? There's no end credits. It just says the end and then it's over. I guess all the credits are at the start. So yeah, I would definitely say I liked the overall story. Apparently, it's basically the same as the short story. The only thing they changed is that the wife in the story committed suicide from the stress of all of this. So they made it a little bit happier where at least she survives. But other than that, it's the same. And yeah, I feel like that would be a great short story. But you can really feel that it's a short story because it just couldn't fill up that runtime. There was a lot of dead time in that movie.
I thought it was well done, and I think it's held up well. I found the ending weak, but the storyline itself and the acting and a little draggy in parts, but very well done. But yeah, that ending was very weak. I mean, there were things that you would have done. They'd spend days looking for that fly. So, for one thing, when the kid saw it in the web, I think the kid would have captured it, would have broke the web, and would have taken the fly. Then when the cop and the man are there at the end and the spider is going to attack it, I think they would have pushed the spider aside. That would have been so easy, right? Push it aside, unless it's a poisonous spider, and they would have taken the thing. The man, when he first discovered it in the web, he runs upstairs to tell the cop, oh, come on, he's in the web, you know, let's go. That's wasting time. Yeah. I think you would have gone to the kitchen and you would have got a cup or something, a bottle or something, and you would have taken it first. And then you would have gone to see the cop. Those little things I found weak, very weak.
Particularly because, yeah, I was okay with the, especially with movies like this, of course, they need to fill the time and, you know, the slow burn or whatever. So I was okay with the pacing at first. I actually liked it at first where it starts at the end of like, why has your husband been crushed in this hydraulic press? What the heck's going on? And then they eventually go back to the science stuff and build up to it. But yeah, then when they finally reveal that he's become part fly, we're pretty deep into the movie, but I'm like, all right, we made it through all the you know, slow parts. Here we are. And that's when they chase the fly. And it's like Clouseau-esque. It just takes forever. They just cannot catch, or they catch it and they let it go and catch it again. Yeah, that's when it's like my goodwill was used up. I'm like, come on, movie, for God's sake. Like, that's where I feel like if it was a double feature, but both the movies in the double feature were the length of one movie, you know, or maybe an hour each, that'd be fine. But at 95 minutes, yeah, it really dragged. But the good parts were so good, like especially because obviously the special effects let it down a bit. You know, it'd be nice if they had a better fly head or whatever, but hey, it's 1958.
But you could believe that. I mean, it really wasn't that bad. And especially I liked the scene where she sees him, the head, for the first time, and she screams and screams and screams, and then you see it through his eyes, and you see any number of her screaming because the sky, because the fly has multiple eyes. Yeah. I thought, oh yeah, okay, that's kind of okay. It's all right.
And yeah, I do think the best part, like I would assume, I don't know, but the thing that made Cronenberg, I'm guessing, want to make a remake is that I feel like the part where everything really came together like perfectly and was really well done is you got this scientist guy who, if anything, is almost annoying because he's so blustery. He's like the prototypical 1950s, like the march of science, the future. Ah, I have a way of seeing reality that few others. And it's just like, shut up. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy will not stop. So then for him to be, to have this cloth over his head and hiding his arm, he can't talk anymore. He has to communicate just by messages he's typed or by knocking for yes or no. And it's so eerie because you know what's under there is horrifying. And just that he went from this guy who couldn't, just loved hearing himself talk, to now he can barely communicate. And then it's even better from there where he starts losing his mind and it's harder to type and he's turning into a fly. Like, that part is so good. That's what I would feel like. I want to do a remake of this to focus in on this one part because it's so good. And then the rest was like pretty good. And then just catching the fly was like, you got to stop with this. that felt like a different movie. That is like, this is so not sensible.
And actually, when you say that in the original story, the wife commits suicide. That actually, of course, you can't have that kind of an ending in the 1950s. You got to have a happy, you know, happy family type ending kind of thing. Right. But that's actually more believable because even though the wife is very strong throughout all this, because she is, she kind of accepts what's happening and she kind of comes right to the foreground with it. But yet she's seen something that's pretty friggin' horrific. She's seen her husband turn into this creature. She has been involved in the killing of him so much so that she's able to put that arm in the press the second time and press the button. But now she is virtually having a nervous breakdown there at the end. And yet at the end, once they discover and destroy the little fly, everything's fine and good and happy. And of course, she's going to have a nice life in the future with Vincent Price because he's been in love with her right from the beginning.
Oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that.
It was too compact an ending. Everything's just happy, happy, happy. You know, everything was black and white now. My God, if you went through what that woman went through, you'd be having nightmares for the rest of your life. Every time there was a bzzz, you'd be like, whoa.
Yeah, the suicide.
Right out.
Suicide's a little harsh, but a lot more believable.
Well, even if they didn't do suicide, but if they had her being like a little off at the end instead of everything's back to normal now, we've got the happy little family.
Or even they could have also just had her be carted away, you know, send her to, if not, you know, jail for murder, maybe if they did just send her to an insane asylum and no one would have needed to see the fly. We could still go to the fly in the web and we know that it's a guy. But no one else needed to even be aware of that.
They could have just left it there. They could have just had the spider do it in. That's it. Story over.
I'm assuming, too, in the short story, because, again, I mean, I don't know how many words they give you in Playboy, but not infinite. So I'm sure it was, you know, the wife coming down into the lab just saying, we tried to catch the fly. We couldn't catch the fly. I'm sure there were not page after page of trying to catch the fly, stumbling around. Like, that's obviously all added in. And that part is so much worse than everything else.
And there were little things like, I mean, these people lived in a pretty friggin' fancy house and they have a maid and perfect house. What are the chances that you'd have a window pane that has a little crack in the bottom of it and an opening, not just a crack in the glass? But the actual piece of glass is gone and nobody's noticed that and nobody's fixed it.
Well, even worse than that, they put down the sugar, the fly lands, they literally catch the fly in the net that the kid has used to catch untold numbers of flies and it got out.
Yeah.
Like it's.
Yeah. And they don't quite say how it got out.
Yeah. It's actually more believable that he has a lab in the basement where he's transporting matter than it is that they just couldn't catch this stupid fly.
Well, especially even just to find the fly. I mean, that would be amazing. What are the, because I kept watching this, what are the chances that you'd ever find that freaking fly? Yeah. Once he got out into the wilderness, oh God, he would be gone for miles.
Or particularly with the reveal at the end that he is, you know, in a similar situation as the fly, you know, where he's at least partially human. He's aware enough to ask for help, you know, he's basically aware. So, yeah, I feel like that could have used a little rewrite of he's always around because he still has, like, his own ability to reason. So
I take back what I said. Like, what are the chances that you'd find that fly? Yeah, because it's part human. It would be hanging around. It would not be going off like most flies would.
But that's where he could come up with some, I don't know, some weird fly method. Well, I guess he could even just try to get into the lab. He knows he needs to get into the lab, so he should be trying to get into the lab.
Yeah.
So, the whole fly side of it was quite underdeveloped.
Yeah, I'll buy that. I'll buy that's why the fly would be around.
But yeah, definitely, though, that stuff really impressed me of him. With the, especially, it's even better before they show the fly head because you just wonder what it is. It's more terrifying not to know, and that he can't communicate anymore and he's losing his mind. Like, but again, too, this guy, as we were watching it, we're like, man, this guy is losing sympathy fast, where not only is he blustery March of Science number one guy, but then he sends his first test of human or of living matter is his beloved cat. And the cat's gone. Cat never came back. And then he puts a guinea pig through. At least, like, put yourself through first. At least, you know, at least he finally did just put himself through. But
especially when he knows how fond the kid is of that, because they made a special little thing of that the kid was going to play with the cat. And the kid is, you know, cozying up to the cat and everything else. And the father knows that. And yet he has no qualms. You're right. No qualms about taking that beautiful little cat, putting it in there, and then you just hear this meowing because the cat molecules are floating around in the somewhere in that place in the lab, and then you never hear it again. Like, what happened to it? Where did it go? Well, I guess you're not supposed to question that.
I did like that, though. I was saying as we watched it, I did like that's like I've never seen that particular take on the mad scientist, because I do always think of just the crazy guy up in the attic, and, you know, he's just like, his hair's all crazy, and, you know, he's Doc Brown from Back to the Future at the best of times. So the idea that this guy's a well put together, fancy pants, Johnny Unitas, set your watch by his haircut, got a family, got a nice house, you know, but he's still down in the lab freaking killing his cat. Like, it was, so yeah, there's so much good stuff about that movie. I just do think it just needed to be tightened up some
tweaking. I thought it was very well done, and it has held up all these years. I loved the fact that there were so many French people in, especially once I discovered that the writer was a French guy, and that they were trying to create that. They started off creating that very French type atmosphere, and it was nice to see something different than we're always seeing, like a very American or North American remakes and all that sort of stuff. So that whole French thing was very interesting. But as the movie went on, they kind of lost it.
Yeah.
Towards the end, it was just lost.
Yeah, whenever there were references to Montreal by the end, I was like, oh yeah, right. Or Monsieur, when someone would say Monsieur. But yeah, I'm very curious to watch the Cronenberg remake, because my presumption is it's going to be, if this was almost the same as the short story, I expect it's going to be nothing like the short story. Because whenever I hear about it, I hear about it as being kind of the grandfather of body horror films, like that it's more based on the actual metamorphosis, you know, the grossness of turning into a bug.
Cronenberg is famous for doing that kind of stuff, like really offbeat, technical stuff.
But yeah, I'm definitely glad instead of just jumping ahead to the Cronenberg one, I'm glad we took this little detour so I could watch this one. And yeah, next week, let's watch the other one. Let's wrap up the fly extravaganza.
All I remembered about it, like I did watch this as a kid, and I remember kept thinking to myself, there's something about help me, help me, help me, in a head and an arm. And that's, of course, the fly at the end.
Even that, I think they did a pretty good job of that, because it's right on that border of almost corny, similar to when you see from the fly perspective with the, you know, the kaleidoscope of eyes. It's like, yeah, it's almost corny, but it's like with him at the end, asking for help, it still maintained the creepiness. It was more creepy than it was corny. So.
And of course, then you get into the whole philosophy of murder. Okay, so she killed a man who had a fly's head and a fly's arm and was being taken over by that fly. The cop killed the reverse of that. Human head, human arm, fly body. Who's guilty?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more. I guess that's the thing. There's a lot more stuff you could delve into, or like it would have even been interesting if they had discovered the little fly version and they're trying to communicate with them. All kinds of stuff you could have done rather than the time filler that they did do. But it's almost too much. Like, there's so many ramifications for what happened in this movie. Like, you could make a whole mini series of what the heck is going to happen with this now. So yeah, I guess they did have to keep it contained to some degree. But yeah, especially of these types of movies of the era, like, I can see why this one stood out a bit, because especially his first reveal that he's turned himself into the fly, like that part, A+, 10 out of 10, so good.
Yeah, well done.